My Radio 1. Sean Daly. With Sean Daly.
From its launch in 1967 right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years as they each tell the story of their Radio 1.
Sean Daly. My Radio 1.
The Top 40 was produced by Martin Cox.
And it is, in fact, Top Radio 2 producer initially, and then with Radio 1, and these days, the man behind Talking Pictures TV. It is Martin Cox. Hello.
Hi, Sean. Nice to see you.
Lovely to see you, Martin. So you joined the Beeb as a graduate trainee. What year was that, roughly?
That would be 1979. I came straight down from Durham University, and lucky enough to get one of the graduate trainee posts. Five of us in all. And the best thing about that was, for me, I didn't really know where in the BBC I wanted to settle, but it was up to 3 years of doing short 3-month attachments in different departments. So it might be the expenses department, as it was at Bush House to start with. Then it was television centre in studio management. And, you know, fantastic place to be. You'd walk around the ring road and there was the TARDIS. You know, it was extraordinary. Yeah. And I was working on Blue Peter and various shows. And then I went to the press office, and then I went to personnel, and then I went to Top of the Pops. And so it was all over the place. And I went in to see my personnel officer, Hilary Jones, one day, and she was on the phone. And she said, "Martin, I'm on the phone. What do you want?" I said, "Well, I just wanted to have a little chat." And she said, "Well, Ted, do you need a station assistant?" She was on the phone to Ted Gorton at BBC Radio Oxford. "And do you want to go and work in radio?" "Yes, I'd love to, Hillary."
"It's 5:30, and this is Peter Grant with the Radio Oxford News."
So I went up the next morning, and Ted booked me as a station assistant at Radio Oxford. And that job entails everything from taking the radio car out and doing news interviews to editing tapes to doing short pieces on local events. But I found myself within 2 weeks on air because Ted liked me and Timmy Mallett was just moving on and he needed someone to do the drive time show.
Today's number one for Madness. Grey Day. Requests and dedications up to 6 tonight, 6 till 7. It's Critics' Choice with Martin.
So how did you go from BBC Radio Oxford back to the BBC here in London?
Well, again, it was a bit of a happenstance, really. I was in Ted Gorton's office and he was on the phone to Derek Mills, who was then running Radio 2. And very similar circumstances, Ted said to me, "Do you want to go down to check out what they do at Radio 2? I said, "Yeah, I'd love to go and have a look," not knowing that it was going to be an interview at all. So I went down the next day to meet Derek Mills and to see what Radio 2 did. And it was a job interview. And apparently, I'm told by Doreen Davis, who was head of Radio 1 at the time.
And Derek's wife, of
course.
And
Derek's wife, absolutely. I was told that Doreen was furious because Derek had heard about me and wanted me to go and work at Radio 2. But so did Doreen. But Derek got in there first. I didn't think I'd ever be able to switch over to Radio 1, but I was very happy at Radio 2. I went straight on to the Jimmy Young Show.
Morning all, thanks to Terry Wogan, of course. Warm welcome to the Jimmy Young programme. Trying to find out today why, despite the millions of pounds that the government has spent on job creation schemes, the number of people out of work is in fact still increasing, how new forms of treatment are making an impact on drunkenness and alcoholism.
I then produced John Dunn for ages, who was a saintly and marvellous man.
Well, let me tell you what lies ahead. After 7, Watergate journalist Bob Woodward, he'll be my special guest. Between now and then, China, who have already started celebrating their new year, and Russia, the sort of arts and crafts that the 1917 revolution demanded should be produced. And my final guest will be Bill Weeks this evening, is down here to lecture about chemical fertilizers. And we'll get a preview of what he has to say around about 7:45.
I produced Gloria Hunniford,
Ed Stewart.
Yes. And, of course, David Hamilton, who I became great friends with and still am. Lovely man, Diddy David. He used to call me Boy Wonder. And because I was so young and he was, you know, like, really? I walked into the studio for the first time. But we had enormous fun together and the ratings were fantastic.
BBC Radio 2, David Hamilton.
Good afternoon. It's November the 14th, and welcome to the David Hamilton Music Show on Radio 2 National Radio with Eighth Wonder. And stay with me until 6 if you can.
And of course, it was great for me because I when Radio 1 was born, I was only 10 years old. But so I lived with it, you know, listening under the bedclothes at night on the transistor radio, and through doing my holiday jobs, working in shoe factories and things, Radio 1 was always on the factory speakers. And so for me to be working with David Hamilton was like the most incredible opportunity. Jimmy Young. I mean, you know, I could remember from my childhood, what's the recipe today, Jim? And all those things. And so it was an amazing opportunity for me. So I worked for Radio 2 for about 4 or 5 years and then got a call from Doreen at Radio 1.
Eventually it happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been, in essence, primarily the fact that you were still so young. You were perfect for the network in that case.
Well, the idea that Radio 1 could bring some young blood in, perhaps a little representative of its audience, was obviously an attractive one.
I've been over in San Francisco recently, and a local radio station ran a competition for schools in the area. And what they had to do was simply to write in to the radio station asking for Go West to come and perform at their school. It was as simple as that. And the winner would be the school who wrote in with the most letters. Do you want to know what the winning total was? The winning total was 1.5 million letters from one school.
Bruno Brooks' Tea Time Show, one of the most high-profile slots on the network. And it was the start of a really great partnership for you both.
The relationship between producer and presenter is absolutely vital. And Bruno wasn't having a great time. He had a very good producer, but they didn't really get on terribly well when I took over. And that was my first gig at Radio 1. And I was absolutely thrilled, of course. Bruno, I think, was a little suspicious at first because he didn't think I'd perhaps got the experience. But we got on so well straight away. We became extremely good friends. We had an enormous amount of fun. And Bruno really being feeling himself in the shadows, he then went on to win DJ Smash Hits DJ of the Year, like 4 years running. And the ratings for the show were fantastic.
And you weren't just producing his weekday programme, but you were working with him on the Sunday Evening Top 40 show too.
5 o'clock is the time in Great Britain. Hello, if you've just joined National Radio 1 on FM. From now until 12, it's all heard in superb stereo, and there's only one way to start, and that's with this. It's Bruno Brooks in the West End of London with Europe's number one countdown. Radio 1's UK Top 40, the most important hit list of hottest selling singles in Great Britain today.
Bruno was the perfect DJ for the chart show. He had the pace and understanding and the urgency that you wanted to hear.
Christopher gets his first number one single with The Lady in Red. That's about it. The Top 40 show is produced by Martin Cox, and don't forget, check out the brand new chart this Tuesday morning with Mike Smith. Next Sunday's Chartbusters and Top 40 show is in the capable hands of Tommy Event, so I'm taking a few days break, but you can hear us on the Radio 1 Roadshow all this week on the Welsh coast. I might just even see you there.
It also meant that you and Bruno would be on the Radio 1 Roadshow together. Now, we talked about it to all the other producers as well. This was like producing no other programme because it meant that you had to go out on stage and do your bit warming up with the crowd. How did you find that?
I loved it. I'm a bit of a theatrical myself, I have to say. I'm a bit of a lovey. So, but I've always been the wrong side of the glass, as it were. But I absolutely loved the roadshow. It was, again, something that I had been to as a child. So to be on stage in my uniform with the headphones on and the microphone and talking to people, it was very, very special. It was blimmin' hard work, but a lot of fun too.
The Radio 1 Roadshow.
CDs become became the must-have item by the mid-80s, and you guys were doing Bruno Brooks Compact Disc Jockey, wasn't it? But we were discussing before we started this programme that this was actually an idea that you tried out first with David Hamilton on Radio 2.
It was, yes. David Hamilton, who is quite short in stature, suited the title the Compact Disc Jockey, which I think he coined himself, in fact, but it was when the very first CDs came out. We did then take it on with Bruno, and he kind of adopted the title.
Ultravox, that's called Reap the Wild Wind. We really have got some great music for you up until 7 o'clock. Elton John, Madonna, Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran, Alan Parsons Project, and much more. There really is quite an extensive collection that you're able to buy on compact disc. I know that because Martin Cox, my producer, apparently, according to him, has the largest collection in the country. And I've seen it. There are hundreds. So quite a selection if you fancy the idea of buying some.
How much influence did you have musically working with your DJs? Was it 50-50 split, or did you tend to have a little bit more influence on it than they did?
In the theory of things, the producer was entirely responsible for everything that was played on the radio. And I would say most of the time that was so, because in actual fact, not all the disc jockeys were very interested in the music. Bruno was. Gary Davis was particularly interested.
That's a track from the excellent Thompson Twins album Into the Gap and No Rest for the Wicked. A lot of classy album material coming your way between now and 5 o'clock. The return of the classiest show on radio.
An unofficial task of a great Radio 1 producer back in the old days was to bail a DJ out of trouble occasionally. And this happened to you not just once, but twice, at the expense of a huge star from the music biz, you were telling me before we began this programme today. Come on, this is a great story, this.
One of my pop idols of all time was Pete Townsend, and from The Who. And I'd never met him, but of course, working at Radio 1, you met all these guys every day, but never met Pete Townsend. So anyway, producing the Bruno Brooks show one night, we're just going to hand over to Janice Long at 7.30, and at 7.26, we just started the last record. And there's the phone call rings, and it's reception. Hello, Martin. Reg here on reception. I've got Mr. Pete Townsend for your interview, sir. Oh, thanks, Reg. On the talk back key to Bruno, were you out last night with Pete? Oh,
I was. I'm so sorry. I invited him on for an interview. I'm so sorry.
Well, Bruno, back on the talk back here. What do you want me to do? He said, well, just get rid of him. I can't. It's Pete Townsend. So I left the studio down into reception. There was Pete Townsend sitting there on the sofa. This was when he had the White City album out. And I went home and said, I'm terribly sorry, Pete. There's been some misunderstanding. And he went absolutely bananas.
Yeah, yeah.
He was promoting the record himself, so he didn't have the record company with him. And absolutely bananas. Anyway, long story short, a couple of years later, I was producing The Breakfast Show with Mike Smith. Come off air at 9.30 to hand over to Simon Bates. 9.26, the phone rings. Hello, Martin. Reg here on reception. I've got a Mr. Pete Townsend in reception. No, not again. Mike, were you? Yes, I was. Out the door, down to reception. There's Pete Townsend. And he just takes one look at me and says, oh, not you again! And walks off.
Incidentally, if you're a big fan of Blondie, you'll know that Chris Stein, who's a member of the band and also Debbie Harry's boyfriend, he's been seriously ill just recently. We've had news here at Radio 1 that he is getting better, so that's good news.
I have to ask you about Debbie Harry.
Mm.
Because, again, through contacts with record companies and what have you, whizzed over to New York, and that was quite a memorable special too.
It was. It was Deborah Harry's return to the scene, recording scene, after a very long gap.
This would be around French Kissing in the USA. Yeah.
That's right. French Kissing in the USA album on Chrysalis Records. And the single was looking good. And so it was... it was up to the producers to try and think of exciting ideas to do out of their own strip programming that they did Monday to Friday. So I put in a proposal to see if I could get to do a proper in-depth interview with Deborah Harry. And it was approved by Doreen and Johnny. So I approached the record company and it was approved by them, and we made all the arrangements. But there was one other producer in the building, Mike Hawkes. And Mike was now kind of doing indie programming. And Mike was very wary. He said, you've got to be very careful with Deborah Harry. She's quite a difficult one. And I'm the only person that's ever interviewed her. And it wasn't that he was jealous. He was actually warning me that she's a really, really, really difficult person to work with. Anyhow, we got it all sorted, and Phil Patterson from Chrysalis, head of promotion for Chrysalis, came out. We flew to New York, and... the one piece of advice that Mike Hawkes had given me before we left, he said, whatever you do, do not be late for Deborah Harry. Okay, we were due in at the hotel at 7 and we were going to meet her for drinks at 7:30 to chat about the next day's interview. It was already 8:15 and we were standing at reception and I was not happy. We were all trying to check into the hotel, the Parker Meridian, and trying to hurry the... And then suddenly this voice from behind says, "You must be the guys from the BBC!" And I turned round, and there, looking like the goddess that had been on my bedroom wall all my teenage years, there she was. She'd been to a photo shoot. She looked absolutely spectacular. She wasn't cross. She wasn't angry. She just said, "Dump your bags, let's go and have a drink." So we sat and chatted and worked out what we were going to do, and it was just thoroughly, thoroughly amazing to be there with her. The next day, she turned up on time. We did a long interview, and we'd kind of hired a double hotel room suite, which so we had a studio and a comfortable room, green room. And we did it. I must say, she didn't look quite the same the following morning.
She said the same about you.
Everything sort of happened at once. We sort of shifted gears and changed our way of doing business, and the organization of the band, you know, sort of fell apart. So that sort of all happened simultaneously. So it seemed like the obvious point to take a break. I certainly had my problems during that period, and Chris and I shared some problems, and we also had separate things that we had to take care of, and that's just really what it is. It's quite simple. We had business things to take care of, and I wanted to go solo, and I had no manager, and there were a lot of things that had to be taken care of.
Now, you talked about Gary Davis earlier on.
Yes.
That was the next program that you moved on to. Gary's Bit in the Middle at lunchtimes, and you actually, you know, geographically did quite a bit of movement with this programme, didn't you? You went around various places. The ferry crossed the Mersey, which had a lot of famous people on it. And you travelled from Blackpool Tower to the Eiffel Tower as well.
Yes, the famous rock and roll tour.
Yes,
yes, they were both fun. The ferry crossing the Mersey one for me was very, very special. I produced it with Malcolm Brown, my very dear friend Malcolm, who of course was at school with the Beatles and everything else and knew Liverpool like the back of his hand. So it was good to have him on board, excuse the pun. We were on the Royal Iris, the ferry, just literally going across the Mersey from one side to the other, just recollecting the great musical history and tradition of Liverpool. And the best thing about it was we had the bootleg Beatles on board, the original bootleg Beatles. And after the programme came off air, me and Malcolm were just sitting on the top deck of the Royal Iris, and we were still going across the Mersey, and you could hear the bootleg Beatles playing downstairs, and the noise was coming up through the air intakes, so you could hear it kind of reflectively on deck. And for me, as a youngster who grew up a real youngster with the Beatles, that was very special. The rock and roll tour, I don't know whose idea that was. It certainly wasn't mine, but it was enormous fun. We started in Birmingham, I think it was, Cannon Hill Park, and then we worked our way down to Dover and then to Paris with the world's largest stick of rock. There was massive rivalry between Smiley Miley and the DJs, and in particular between Smiley Miley and Mike Reed. So the programme was double-header between Mike Reed and Gary Davis, and they were always playing pranks on each other. So Mike Reed had arranged during the programme to get Smiley Miley up on the stage, and while he was distracted broadcasting, he got all the local bricklayers to build a brick wall around the Goodymobile. So when he came off air, he couldn't sell any of his merch. So he was a bit upset about this. So Smiley decided to get back at Mike the next day. And so Mike was driving a really nice vintage Triumph TR5 in those days. So Smiley got a crane, craned the TR5, and live during the show, slowly lowered it into the boating lake in Cannon Hill Park. Those, you know, nothing to do with broadcasting, but those were the sort of things that went on behind the scenes.
Jolly James, yeah. There was a brief period producing Simon Bates for you as well, a very different broadcaster, but hugely popular and very powerful too.
Yes, indeed. There was a reorganisation in my final year or so at Radio 1. in order to get some kind of consistency between the programming, I think it was, they decided rather than have individual producers on each program, they would appoint two producers called sequence producers. So I was responsible for the morning sequence, which was Adrian John, Early Show, Mike Smith, Breakfast Show, and Simon Bates, Mid-Morning.
The UK's favourite DJ.
Good morning, world. Going right back to the year when Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space, but which was the year?
Simon was... he was an incredibly professional DJ, but a law unto himself. I mean, as we all know, thank you, love, Simon, yes. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was very good at it. It was a little difficult sometimes, but you just had to keep your nerve and realise that you were producing the programme together. You were a team. Mm-hmm. Just as we were with Gary and Bruno, Simon and I were a team. And I think he respected what I did for him, and I certainly respected what he did. His phone bill was always quite large.
And Mike Reed, you've talked about. Yeah. You also looked after him doing... Well, I mean, in essence, it was... Radio 1 Roundtable, but it was repackaged for a while as Singled Out. You must have met some real characters during that programme that were coming in and reviewing the records.
It was an attempt to get into the daytime sequence some clear guidance about new music coming out, rather than just play a new single from a new band called Climby Fisher that no one had ever heard of and just, you know, dispose of it. It was actually to talk a little bit about who was there, and artists would come in and discuss the music scene. Very, very interesting. I mean, all kinds of guests.
Guests tonight are Boy George.
Hi there.
And Dee Lewis.
Hello.
And these are the records, kicking off with a new single from Bros.
Mike was an absolute angel to work with. Really knew his music, really well behaved, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Very intelligent guy, great fun, and really good with the pop stars, I think, because he always wanted to be one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, my children grew up to some of his songs. You know, the green, I want to be a frog, I'm a frog, and I'm green. Do you remember that one, Mike?
Why do you think you didn't go first time?
I think they didn't have their faces on the cover.
The right haircuts.
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's sometimes it takes a long time to get your foot in the door. You know what it's like.
Mm.
But I think it's going to go this time, obviously.
Because a lot of the time you can have a lot of talent, you can have great songs, but you've just got to get your face there, George, haven't you? You've got to get right in there, as you know, and just smack in between the eyes.
I think with Bros it's more to do with that a lot of people really fancy them, don't they? I mean, they're just really hot property. I like it, it's good. I think, again, I agree with her, it's the best thing, best song. I like it.
They have sort of transcended the teeny market now and making some good class singles.
I know, they still make me scream.
Mm. But Martin, such a long BBC career when you look back, Radio 2 initially, and then Radio 1 through such, as we've already documented in our conversation, such an important part in the radio station's history. And the audiences were just humongous, weren't they? You must feel incredibly proud looking back.
I do. I was fortunate enough to work with David Atkey and produce the 50th anniversary party for the Golden Years. And when you looked around that room and saw the faces that were there and the skill level of the people that were there, it was an amazing gathering. It was a private party, about 400 of us, and you looked around and you think, my God, over the years, what these people have done and I was able to be a part of was absolutely amazing. I was terribly privileged to be so young working at a radio station that I'd grown up with in my early teenage years. And I was there and I was able to be part of it. The next door office had two legends sitting in it called John Peel and John Walters. I mean, you couldn't get in through the office door. It was sort of completely piled. But these are people, you know, I'd grown up with these people and I had been part of it. And that gave me enormous confidence, because I was a little terrified at first, but because they were all really good people and they really knew their stuff, they were real pros, they really were, they knew their music, they trusted their instinct, and that rubbed off on me and started my career in a big way too. I'm very, very proud to have worked for Radio 1, and I, you know, have to thank lovely Doreen Davis in particular and Derek Mills for getting me into it.
Martin Cox, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your Radio 1.